Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The Ravencast. I'm Suzanne Ross, and my colleague Adam Erickson is here via his microphone. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Suzanne. How are you today?
Good. Adam's going to be monitoring the chat room, so as the conversation goes on, please feel free to post your comments and questions in there for Neil, and we will be sure we get to them. Today, we have the honor of interviewing retired Maryland State Police Major Neil Franklin. Welcome, Neil.
Hey, Suzanne. Hey, Adam. How you doing?
Good, Neil. How are you today?
Great.
Awesome.
Good. Neil, I met you a few weeks ago at the Theology and Peace Conference, and you have a very powerful personal story that takes you from the streets of Baltimore as a proud warrior in the war on drugs to someone who is now the executive director of an organization called LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, working for the legalization of drugs and you've come to view the drug war as failed policy. So you may or may not know that our tagline at the Raven Review blog site is "Change Your View, Change the World." And glad you do, because you sort of exemplify what we're talking about. You know, when most of us woke up on Sunday morning to the news of what had happened in Orlando, right, we wanted to change the world. It's very hard to hear and to witness again these sorts of incidents of gun violence. And so this is why I reached out to you this week, especially because you are a voice of hope and a possibility for change, not just your personal narrative, but what you're doing professionally as well. So thank you so much for being here during this very important time in the national debate on drugs, war, terror, gun control, all of that. I would like to start by talking about that incident in Florida, the massacre at the nightclub in Orlando, and then the surprising response of the Senate having a filibuster yesterday about proposing new gun closing loopholes, I guess, in gun purchasing laws. And I wondered, before we get to the policy, just, you know, what was your response to that news Sunday morning as, you know, as a human being and as a law enforcement officer?
Yeah, well, I mean, immediately recognizing the travesty here and just hearing the sheer number of people who died at the hands of one person in one night early one morning, my heart sank. Again, we are witnessing just violence, you know, and people talk about gun violence, they talk about domestic violence, they talk about war. At the end of the day, for me, it's just how do we reduce the violence globally, period? Okay, whether it's a single person committing an act like in Orlando, whether it's, you know, the domestic violence that we have among our partners, whether it's the violence we see in our schools, how do we move our society in general from a place of violence to a place of peace and respect for one another? And, you know, and I understand, well, it's going to be a very difficult task, but I don't think it's impossible to have some significant improvement here. And we just need to get to work, each and every one of us. I think there are just so many of us, there are far more many of us that want peace and who want to do the work. It's just a matter of doing it. And you don't have to do anything big, just within your own sphere of influence, in your own little circle. If each and every one of us did the best that we could, you know, to mitigate conflict, to talk to people, to de-escalate situations, you know, and to help get people the mental health that they need, you know, the services that they need. If we all just did what we could in our own little circles of influence, I think there's enough of us to make a significant difference in violence in the world.
Yes, I think you're right. And I think we also need to like have a little leadership on these things. I think that's really
a lot of leadership.
We need a lot of leadership because I think you're right. The majority of people and the vast majority of people in this country are tired of war and tired of violence. And it's part of why I think your leadership is so important, because you're speaking from within a system that is suffering from too much violence and needs, you know, is desperate for reform. I'm wondering what your reaction is to the proposals right now that our Senate is supposedly voting on that. I think I'm not really an expert on gun legislation, but I think it's to prevent someone who's been investigated by the FBI for terrorism, right?
Yeah, if you're on the so-called do not fly list, right? Mm-hmm. They want to, if you're on that list, you also cannot buy, meaning you cannot buy firearms. I think the question here is, how do you get on that list? You know, what are the details of being on that list? Can someone who's, you know, a member of the FBI, can someone who's a member of some law enforcement agency or some part of government just place you on the list because we just happen to be looking at you? What is the criteria? You know, can someone, for instance, I've got 34 years in law enforcement. Can someone say from the FBI to say, hey, I think I'm going to take a look at Neil Franklin. And while I'm doing that, I'm going to place him on the do not buy list, the do not fly list, do not buy list. So I think we really have to look at the criteria, because if we start, you know, if we have a process where people can easily be placed on such a list that restricts their freedoms in this country that is supposed to be about freedoms, if we just randomly start placing people on such a list with no controls, with no specifics, with very little oversight, you know, can it be abused?
Yeah.
And will people then suffer regarding their rights from being placed onto that list? So I have no problem with such a list, you know, being used for that. But my concern is, what's the criteria and checks and balances for placing people on a list?
Mm-hmm. I sort of hear echoes of your discussions of the sort of institutionalized racism that becomes part of how we so-called police in minority communities. Mm-hmm. And I hear your fear of that. You know, I mean, it may be different issues maybe not color, but of religion or nationality that could enter into an overzealous application of this kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, here's an example. Just listen to the rhetoric from Donald Trump, right?
Yeah.
His rhetoric about Muslims. I get, you know, if he had an option, if he was the one placing the names on the list, every Muslim would be on that list.
Yeah.
And probably every Mexican would be on that list, because he's made statements about, you know, how they are criminals. You know, just these blanket statements, you know, about them causing so much of the harm and crime in this country, which is not true. But so that's kind of like my point in what you were saying about the disparity issues of having such a list and the processes. You've got to have the right checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And there's got to be some recourse. If I'm placed on a list, you know, it'd be nice to know that I'm on a list, not to get to an airport and realize, oh my God, I can't fly, or go to purchase a gun and realize now that I'm on some kind of list. So there's got to be a process for me as a citizen to be able to say, hey, I don't deserve to be on that list and I want to challenge it. So if there's no process for challenging being on a list, that's another problem.
Yeah, it seems like they were addressing that in the I watched a few hours of the back and forth yesterday. I think the last time I watched C-SPAN was when Oliver North was testifying in Iran-Contra. That was the thing that got my interest. But they were talking about this, that it would have to go through the Attorney General, that there'd have to be a process for appeal. And I guess you would have to be notified, you know, that you're just placed on this and not randomly being, you know. So, okay. What as a law enforcement officer who was dealing in situations where, you didn't know who had guns among the civilian population, what sort of reform do you think would be helpful in reducing violence in our communities, violence, of civilians on civilians, but also of police on civilians, civilians on police. What would you like to see happen?
Oh, wow. That's a pretty good question. A lot of possible answers. So let me first begin with, you know, the one issue that is obviously on the minds of so many people, especially since the recent shooting. And, you know, again, that is the policies surrounding our firearms in this country, you know, who has access. Mm-hmm. First, there definitely needs to be a process, a regulatory process of, you know, again, who can buy. You know, we have so many people who have committed these acts who are dealing with severe mental health issues and problems. You know, we're learning that in many cases, people knew of what someone was about to do. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've got to get better on encouraging people to report when they suspect someone is about to get involved in such a thing. So it relates to policing. Let me begin with this quote from Benjamin Franklin. He says, "Those who sacrifice freedoms for safety deserve neither." And again, that is about this country and the freedoms of this country. And I definitely don't want this country to be like some of our other countries. We're very restrictive in the freedoms of people. And that's, you know, so I just wanted to make that point. I think that if the police, number one, become better at improving the relationships between police and community, that would obviously result in much more support from the community for our police.
Yeah.
When you have that type of collaboration, instead of an us versus them mentality and situation, when it's truly we are one and the same, we are just the small group of folks within a community, you know, who pay attention to crime and violence 24/7. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, public safety is a community responsibility, first and foremost. As people are committing violent acts against one another, let me just say the police cannot keep you safe, because a violent act occurs instantaneously, and the police cannot be 24/7 wherever everyone is. The police typically respond to an incident. Then they investigate the incident, hoping to find the perpetrator and prevent that person from committing additional acts of violence. That's pretty much what the police do. But if you have a community that is really one and the same with the police, and I don't want to use the term partnered with the police, because when you say partners, that means you are two separate entities. You have to be one and the same. People in the community learn about potential violence way before the police do. They can sense things. They know when there's a conflict among two, three, or more people. And when and if they had that relationship with the police, they can then notify the police that, hey, this is what I heard. This is what I know. This is what I think. Mm. Might want to look into it. And here are the people involved. Mm-hmm. And then the police can be proactive in reaching out to those folks to do some de-escalation, to do some mitigation, you know, whatever the case may be, whatever's warranted, to head off any acts of violence. Mm-hmm. Most of the people are dying in our streets in this country today because of gang violence, because of the war on drugs, because of people selling drugs, trying to make money, warring with each other, cruising gangs, fighting each other. The cartel is very much and very well established in this country. Mm-hmm. The conflicts that come from that. They initiate there in many cases. And then once an act of violence occurs between these gangs and crews, then you have retaliation. So then it's back and forth, shooting after shooting. So yes, in Orlando, and in many of our communities, San Bernardino, in many of our communities, we have these violent acts from these one or two, whether homegrown or other type of terrorists, we do have those. But most of the people, the thousands of people that we're losing every year in this country, is just from the street violence that I'm talking about here within our cities and towns across this country.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've got to be focused on that. We've got to be willing to do the work, not just scratching the surface, but really digging down deep into asking and finding out why. Why are people shooting at each other in our neighborhoods and in our streets?
Mm-hmm.
Why the conflict? And let's not look at this just on its surface, but we really have to dig deep, and one of those submerged foundations is the war on drugs, is the conflict that we have there and what spins off of that. That's also a main reason that police aren't, well, let me put it this way. The war on drugs, the prohibition of drugs, the policy is actually counterproductive to public safety. Now, this conversation we're having here, it's clear these policies make our communities more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And the police are the ones given the task of going into the communities and enforcing these policies. And of course, that's going to lead to violent conflicts between, first and foremost, between the gangs, the crews, the people selling drugs, and the police. And then second, the police get to a point where sometimes they get frustrated, and everyone appears at sometimes to be a potential drug dealer. You know, racial profiling in this country today is centered squarely on top
mm-hmm.
of these drug policies and the police going out to enforce these drug policies. We want to search you. We want to search your car. We want to search your home. And that's what we're focused on 70 to 80% of the time of us being out there doing our work.
One of the things that you really opened my eyes to, Neil, when we had a chance to talk a little bit at Theology and Peace, was this issue of selective enforcement. Mm-hmm. You really pointed out to me that the communities are police differently. So in a right. In the North Shore suburban community where I live, you know, I know, God forbid, my own kids got caught, but you know, they had pot in their trunks and in their glove compartments, but no police officer, no sniffing dogs come by on you know, the main street in downtown Glenview. But in downtown Chicago, on the south side, kids are pulled over, people are stopped all the time. And this gets to the heart of this trust issue that you're getting to yeah. between the police and the community, where it's so adversarial in minority communities, and they feel unfairly treated because they are being unfairly policed.
Right.
And so how do you, you know, I mean, that's the thing, you have to recover this sense of partnership, but that we're in this together. Safety is everyone's responsibility. But the situation, the way it exists now, it's especially in Chicago, we're just having a hard time with transparency issues, with getting the police to open up and investigate these sorts of misconduct cases in public view, because the police feel besieged too. So I don't know, you know, give us words of hope. Preach to us.
Well, there's small glimmers of hope as relates to reform here in Maryland. During our past legislative session, early spring, we were able to, well, last year after the Freddie Gray incident, where Freddie Gray lost his life in the back of one of our Baltimore City transport vans, our state legislator formed a working group to take a look at policing policies, to take a look at our training commission, police training commission, you know, to take a look at the police officer's bill of rights, anything that could limit transparency, which you just mentioned. You know, transparency is extremely important as it relates to building trust with the community. Mm-hmm. So the working group came up with 23 recommendations to be put into legislation during our past session. And believe it or not, all 23 of these recommendations were placed into that into a piece of legislation. And some of these, just a couple that are important, is, for instance, when there is a hearing for police misconduct, you know, excessive force, maybe brutality, those hearings, according to the Police Officer's Bill of Rights here in Maryland, could only be staffed by law enforcement people.
Yeah.
Which limited transparency. It made all the decisions were being made within the policing environment. Very, very opaque. And so now one of the recommendations was to allow for trained civilians to be on these hearing boards. So now police chiefs in the state of Maryland will have that option to place trained civilians on these hearing boards. And as long as the community places enough pressure upon the police chief and the mayor or city manager, then that will happen. But at least the opportunity is there to do that. Mm-hmm. The training commission itself, that board who decided on all training and hiring standards for policing in the state of Maryland, because they had to they have to certify all police officers, board will now have civilian members on it. It will now have legislators on it. It will now have, it's opened up to other people being on that board, members who are not police officers.
Mm-hmm. And who come from the community that's being policed. I think that's one of the things you really emphasized to me, was that in minority communities, mm-hmm. they need to be the ones that the police chief is answering to a civilian committee board, oversight board. I don't know whatever the structure would be, but you have it well worked out in terms of proposals for how to get the community's voice to be heard. Because certainly in Glenview, the police hear my voice. I don't want to get the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But Southside,
yeah,
that voice is in the
yeah, and
hard.
You know, and right now, you know, when you address this issue of why we police differently in our poor Black and Brown communities versus some of our affluent communities, where you've stated clearly that, yeah, there's a lot of drugs in our affluent communities. Believe me, there is. But we don't go into those communities with drug sniffing dogs and scanning cars or doing what we call knock and talks, walking up to somebody's door like and knocking. And just when they open the door, we just see what we can see and smell what we can smell. Mm. You know, we do that in our poor communities, in our Black and Brown communities, but we would never do that in an affluent community. Now, law enforcement would say, well, you know, we enforce differently because of the violence that's in the poor Black and Brown community. So we're enforcing that way because of the violence that's there. But I'll tell you something, you know, and I've thought of this. So what if the violence wasn't there? What if the people who were selling the drugs on the corners had come up with agreements among themselves that, hey, we're going to treat this like a business. We're not going to fight each other. We're going to work things out. We're going to put the guns down, but we're going to go and we're going to sell our drugs. We're going to use our drugs. Would the police be acting and policing the same way? I'd say it's going to be pretty close. I don't see a lot of change unless, as you said, we have great leadership, you know, and that leadership who would then say, okay, the violence is not there. Let's just treat this as a health issue. Okay, let's try to move this into a place of regulation and control. But first and foremost, let's identify the people who are addicted and provide services for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the people who are addicted have multiple issues going on. There's also mental health issues and problems there. We see that a lot with our homeless population, which is quite significant here in Baltimore, and I know Chicago. So, you know, we've really got to have the leadership, get the leadership in place that can see these things for what they really are, and to have the courage, you know, to treat them as such and not be concerned about ensuring that they're going to have enough votes for the next election cycle. You know, I say this, if you're a mayor, think about just being a one-term mayor. That way, maybe hopefully you'll have the courage to do what's right within the community and to lead accordingly. And if you do so, I guarantee you, people will vote for you again. Politicians will quickly tell you, I have two major concerns, two major priorities. Number one is to get elected. Number two is to get elected again.
So we have a comment from the chat room that from Suzanne Hukari, who's asking a question, Neil, that I'm hearing a lot since Sunday's tragedy. It's specifically about guns and what kind of guns there are available to buy. Guns that seem to have nothing to do with hunting deer. The gun that was used, I'm hearing, was an AR-15. Washington Post now says it's a Sig Sauer MCX. I'm not sure what those guns are, but I'm hearing that they are meant for this kind of mass casualty. That there's not much else that's the obvious purpose for them. So is that correct? Do you have thoughts on these kinds of guns?
Yeah, well, first of all, just for clarification, AR-15 is typically AR-15 is the model of an assault rifle. Most people hear that, so anytime they see anything that resembles in style an assault rifle, they use the term loosely AR-15. At the end of the day, whether it's an AR-15, whether it's a Sig Sauer, whether it's one of these other manufacturers, at the end of the day, an assault rifle is an assault rifle. They are semi-automatic, and I think it's important to say this because I've heard the term machine gun used as it relates to this case dealing with in Orlando. He did not have a machine gun. A machine gun, rapid-fire weapon, all I got to do is pull the trigger, hold the trigger in, and I'm shooting off, you know, 30 rounds in less than a second. He didn't have a machine gun. Machine guns, for the most part, are illegal. And if you do own a machine gun, you have to have a special federal tax stamp to have one. There are very few around. He had a semi-automatic assault rifle, and I prefer that we use the term assault rifle instead of specific name, assault rifle, which every time you fire around, you have to pull the trigger. Just like any other handgun, you know, you have to pull the trigger time and time again. So that's what he had. So these assault rifles, very seldom, very few people, if any, use them for hunting animals. They were designed for war, for combat. They were designed not for close quarter combat, but for shooting at a distance. Any long barrel gun is for shooting at a distance, for accuracy at a distance. This, in looking at the diagram of this nightclub, is very close quarters. And I'll tell you something. Knowing what I know about firearms, if this young man had had two semi-automatic handguns, say like a Glock handgun, which some carry 17 rounds in a clip, some carry 19, there's even one that carries 21 in a clip. If he had one of these in each hand, and maybe with a, and you can attach laser scopes to him, he could have done much more damage with one of those in each hand, easy to reload, just like the assault weapon that he had. But being in close quarters the way he was, he could have done far more damage. So I think it's, again, let's not, when something like this happens, let's not go immediately and focus upon the weapon that was used. Because whether it was an assault rifle or whether he had semi-automatic handguns, the outcome would have been at least the same, if not worse. Again, it is about number one, why did he do it? Are we dealing with mental health issues? He had access to purchasing a weapon, which is a problem. Apparently, from what I'm hearing, others may have known, including, I believe, his ex-wife, may have known what he was up to. So I'm talking about things even before he enters into the nightclub. And then once he's in the nightclub, there is absolutely no resistance, from what I'm hearing, from what I'm reading. There was no resistance for a couple of hours. We train police officers for active shooting scenarios. When we know that someone is actively engaged in shooting other people, we train police officers to deal with that immediately and not to wait for a SWAT team, a special trained unit, to arrive on the scene. I don't know what the details are of that night, but I have a significant question. Why in this case was there not a team assembled immediately of the first officers arriving on the scene, and hopefully they're trained in active shooter scenarios? Why did they not enter that nightclub? Mm-hmm. Could they not get in? Was the door barricaded? You know, what were the circumstances there? And I hope they're really looking into that, because a lot of lives could have been saved. Because when you reflect back on some of these other incidents where police officers took immediate action once they arrived on the scene, many, many lives were saved when they were able to neutralize the shooter. Mm-hmm. I'll end with this. You see, because we can't really stop people from hurting other people if they decided to do so. The best thing that we can do once they begin is to start to do something to reduce the level of violence and the number of people hurt. When I first heard of this and I started to hear of the lack of response, from immediate response from law enforcement, I initially thought of the flight back on 9/11 that went down over Pennsylvania. Hmm. And those people aboard that flight decided that they were going to take action to neutralize the terrorists on the plane. And it even meant them sacrificing their own lives. We as a people, we have to realize that this is something we have to be prepared for. We should be thinking about it at least. I know it's something hard to prepare for, but we should at least be thinking about it. That when something like this does happen, somebody, whoever is there, has to do something. Has to do something. You know, it's really problematic for me to be walking down the street and to see someone in desperate need of help and no one helps. It is extremely problematic for me to then see people pulling out their phones and recording it. You can go right on YouTube and you can see people who have been hit by cars, people who have been assaulted, people who are being assaulted, and no one comes to help. We as a people in this country, we have to change our attitudes in response to these types of things, and we have to get involved. And when we start to get involved, I really believe that we will see less and less of this, because people will then know that, hey, others are going to immediately get involved and come to the aid to the aid of people who need help. Mm. Again, the police cannot keep you safe. You have to be prepared to keep your, once something happens, you have to be prepared to respond and keep yourself and others safe. But yeah. Again, the important work needs to be done way on the front end, the foundations of why people are violent. We've got to do that work within our communities. And you know what? It's really about love and peace. It's really about love and peace. And that, and again, within your own circle of influence, every day, you should be spewing love and peace from your mouth, you know, from your actions, mm-hmm. Your interactions with other people. And that's what we've got to promote. We've got to start spreading that. And love is going to win. Peace is going to win at the end of the day, but we've got to be committed to it.
Yeah. Well, and that's a wonderful sort of, probably, I know you were involved professionally in training police officers, right? Weren't you responsible for that? I mean, do you talk about love when you're training police officers, that they should love the constituency that they're serving? Because that would be helpful. I just want to comment again, just come back to the Orlando situation, because some people are saying that things might have turned out better if some of the civilians in the room were armed. You're saying we should defend ourselves, we should take action in these kinds of situations. Do you think that would have been helpful if someone had a gun in there or made things worse?
My professional opinion is that it would have made things better. That's my professional opinion. I'm going to be straight honest with you. There are very, very few places I go where I'm not armed. You know, it would be completely different if this were a society where no one had guns. Okay, then I wouldn't need a gun. But we have to understand something. There are more guns in this country than people. And until we get to a place, if the people of this country want to move to a place of disarming citizens, until we get to that place, then you know what? There are going to have to be certain citizens that have arms. Because if you start, and in my personal opinion here, if you start disarming the citizens who would be capable of responding to this type of terrorism and violent act, then it's going to be open season. It's going to be a field day. You know, this is a very, very difficult thing to resolve as we think about how do we do this thing with the firearms that we have in this country. You know, yeah, we have the Second Amendment. What does that mean? You know, do we just increase our regulations for controlling them? You know, what does it mean? What can we do? Do we have to, you know, do we have to repeal the Second Amendment? You know, it's a lot that needs to be discussed. And then again, at the end of the day, say this country and the people in this country decided, okay, we want a society that is free of handguns, that is free of assault weapons. How do you make that happen in this country? You might be able to do it over the next 100 or 200 years, but these firearms do not just disappear when you want them to disappear. You know, people have them in their homes. You know, are you going to invoke policies and laws where you have the government now going knocking on your door to retrieve your firearms? I don't know. It's a very difficult place to be, but until we get to that place, until we come up with the solutions that we think will work and the processes that we think will work, I'm going to be straightforward with you. Mm-hmm. I will carry my firearm. And yes, I've been trained, not just physically how to use it, but in judgment. It's a very difficult question, but I'll say also about the Orlando shooting, there were obviously a lot of people in that club. There have been many, many scenarios where unarmed people have actually taken control of one perpetrator, who have taken control of one person committing the act. You know, it takes courage, though. I mean, I wouldn't want to put anyone in that situation to where they're unarmed and now they have to confront someone who's armed in order to save the lives of others.
Mm-hmm.
But it has happened. And I think it will continue to happen. And I, you know what? I think it will. I think we as a people, I think you're going to start to see people really stepping up to the plate, that when something like this happens, there was another scenario that just recently happened where I believe it involved the young singer who was shot. I believe that was resolved by someone confronting the shooter,
yeah,
who was not armed, you know, and it takes courage to do that. So there are things that we can do.
Yeah.
It's a very, very tough scenario in this country where firearms are so prevalent and we have this thing called the Second Amendment. And again,
yeah,
the writers of the Second Amendment, we didn't have assault weapons when the Second Amendment was put in place. You know, we had muskets where we had to load one round at a time. So,
yeah, not very accurate either.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, Neil, I would be very happy to travel with you anywhere and go into any venue knowing you were carrying a firearm, because I know you. I know you've been trained and I trust your judgment, but I can't say that about too many people. And part of my vision and my hope for changing the situation is what you pointed to, as maybe impossible, but I think we have to get these guns that are in circulation out of circulation, because there's just too damn many. We just don't need them. And I know a lot of people in favor of disarming the nation point to what happened in Australia after a mass shooting a few years ago, and the nation, they voluntarily turned in weapons. There was like an amnesty or something. And he said, bring them in. Just bring them in. We'll take them. We'll get rid of them. No questions asked, whether it's legally or, you know, whether you possess it legally or not. And I have to say that's sort of a fantasy dream scenario that I have. That, because I think you're right. I mean, I think you're unfortunately being very realistic that if there is so much risk from just the sheer volume of guns that are in circulation, it's frightening. It's just frightening. And people do want to know, how do I protect myself?
Right.
And it's just, it's impossible. I mean, for me, it's, if we're going to come into conflict with each other, let's make the conflict as non-lethal as possible. You know, let's get the things that can really, in a fraction of a second, destroy me and take my life, get them out of the place.
So let me just throw this out here real quick. And I really love your dream. So, first of all, if we were to attempt something like that here, to ask people to do that, you know, the first thing you're going to, I think one of the first challenges is that, like, these assault weapons, people pay thousands of dollars for.
Yeah.
So are you going to pay them to turn in something that's worth $2,000? And some people have 10 of them, you know, why, I don't know. But so now you're talking significant money. That's going to be interesting. A lot of people, I think, will, you know, if I've got this little revolver that my dad had or whatever, yeah, I'll probably turn that in. But I'm going to tell you something, as long as we have situations where we have policies that, you know, make it possible for people and gangs to sell drugs on our street corners, these gangs are not going to turn in their guns.
No.
Because that's their livelihood. You know, that's their protection for selling drugs in an illegal market. All right. Now, if it were a regulated and controlled market, and which meant we didn't have people on street corners selling drugs and fighting each other, then that'd be a different story. So a lot's going to happen because drug dealers and gang members aren't going to turn their guns in as long as they need them for conducting the business that which is they see as their livelihood. And as long as that's not going to happen, I guarantee you're going to have a lot of citizens that are going to say, as long as I know these criminals have guns, I'm not giving mine up.
Right.
It's
right.
Going to take a lot of work, but I like how you're thinking.
I like how you're thinking because I think that decriminalizing drugs, I mean, you use the analogy to prohibition of alcohol, which I think it just makes a lot of sense to me that when alcohol was illegal, we had huge violence connected with it. Chicago's well known for that.
And extremely high rates of murder.
Right. And then as soon as it was legal again, all of that violence settled down.
Absolutely. The murder rate, you know, during that decade of alcohol prohibition, the murder rate soared in this country. But immediately after ending it in 1933, I mean, literally, when you see this on a chart, this graph goes straight into the basement as far as the murder rate in this country. And it stays there all the way up until the 1970s and 80s. And then it starts to climb again once we start the war on drugs, making literally repeating alcohol prohibition, but just with a different drug.
Right. But and it seems that it was, you know, there's so much discussion about how the war on drugs is just sort of another way to institute sort of, you know, legal institutionalized racism, because the war on drugs was targeted against, somehow ended up, you know, being used against minority communities, as we talked about earlier. And so one of my questions for you, Neil, is that what broad lessons do you think you would want us to take away from what we've learned from this so-called failed war on drugs that we might, not so-called failed, but so-called war on drugs, that we might apply to what's going on right now in the war on terror? Because your assertion that prohibition of drugs made our communities more violent resonates, connects with me in the sense that I really think our war on terror is making the global community more violent. It seems there's some lessons we could learn from the war on drugs that might apply to the war on terror. Maybe that's too big of a stretch, but I wonder if you, it just seems sort of connected because of the Orlando shooting now, you know, everyone says, is it a terrorist attack? Is it a hate crime? Is it, what is it? But it's definitely a gun violence. It all seems to be all intertwined to me.
Well, one of the things that I see, and you're right, it is a big stretch, but there's clearly one thing that I see, is that when we put policies in place that in a sense promote a separation between the citizens and government, and you know, for instance, the war on drugs is so responsible for the separation of police and community. Mm-hmm. You know, again, because of the racial profile and because of the disparate policing that we do in Black, Brown, poor communities, we've arrived at a place where many of our police officers, you know, they see every young Black man who's wearing some jeans, sagging a little bit with a hoodie on, got to be a drug dealer, you know, and they treat him as such, you know, and the disrespect and then the problems that come from that and the separation. So now you've got communities that have, they don't want anything to do with the police. They don't offer information to the police. They don't report crimes to the police. because they don't want any engagement with the police, even as a victim. So they don't even report crimes to the police in their communities. What does this mean? It means that someone can come into a community who has evil intent as relates to terrorism and just start to do whatever they want to do and go unnoticed. Well, they could be noticed, but no one's going to report them to the police. You know, no one's going to report any strange behavior to the police. These policies also tend to separate people from people within the community as well. You know, the overcriminalization of a community also does a lot to disrupt the family units. And when family units are disrupted the way they are from our criminal justice system, you know, you got an uncle in prison, you've got a father in prison, you may have, you know, you got siblings in prison, and these family units aren't working well together, and community falls apart. Mm-hmm. When community falls apart, how can I say it? Terrorists can hide within those communities. If you've got a community that really works, where people talk to one another, they engage with one another, they help each other out, they're concerned about their neighbors, it's going to be very difficult for a terrorist to set up shop within that community, to come in and start living within that community, because you know what? This is a healthy community where you're going to have people knocking on that person's door saying, hey, welcome to the community. You know, I just want to introduce myself. They're going to engage whenever they can, and they're going to be suspicious and saying, whoa, wait a minute. Something wrong there, you know, or whatever the case may be. We, the people, community, families, and the way we interact with one another, we are the best first line of defense for any type of terrorism. And if we have policies in place, such as the war on drugs, and now we're dealing with the war on terror and the Patriot Act and so many other things that where the government is beginning to intrude into your life, listening to cell phone or monitoring cell phone conversations, you know, huge clumps of data that are being collected on citizens and where all this is leading. Again, in my opinion, it's not leading to a very good place. The war on drugs began the militarization of our police departments in this country. And now it's being we're kind of like trying to unravel the war on drugs, which would help to unravel the militarization of our police departments. The war on terror is coming right in, you know, creating another platform, another reason for having MRAPs, another reason for having these, you know, assault rifles, machine guns, assault vehicles, you know, by our police departments. And so if we continue down the road of the war on terror the way we are, we're going to have a very difficult time getting our police departments away from militarization, you know, and that militarized response. You know, even the uniforms that our police officers, many of them wear today, which resemble or almost identical to what the military wears. You know, when you put someone in a military uniform, you're going to get a military response. You're going to get a military type attitude. And it, in my mind, and from what I've seen, it creates more separation between police and community. So it's a lot to it, but I'm seeing pieces of the war on terror almost replacing pieces of the war on drugs.
Yeah.
And on a global scale, you know, it's going to be extremely important that down the road we're going to need leaders who can first and foremost travel the road of being a diplomat, traveling the road of first and foremost finding solutions of peace, you know, before you even consider any type of conflict involving our military, which would always, should always be a last resort. And I don't know, the current leaders, what we're seeing in this election on a national scale, it's rather frightening. We need leaders who know how to bargain in a peaceful way.
Yeah. I believe that you've put your finger on something that's so important, is that we need to acknowledge that violence sort of permeates all aspects of our culture. And it does seem to be a method of achieving our ends that isn't always called into question.
You get violence. Okay, violence brings more violence. And that's one of the things, you know, something that you reminded me of. It's one of the things we need to get our police officers focused on in doing their work. I've got to mitigate this incident, this circumstance, without using violence.
Right.
You know, I've got to do everything that I can, beginning with talking to people, beginning with, you know, how I treat people, respecting people, not cursing at people, talking at a nice, an even tone. I got to do everything that I can. And of course, I need that base of knowledge. I need the training. I need the information. But I've got to do everything that I can to mitigate every circumstance that I'm involved in without using violence.
That's the key to, I think, yeah, to transforming communities, because that's where the leadership has to come from. In every situation, anyone who's in the situation of authority or power needs to be showing the way that nonviolence is the primary mode of our way we're going to interact with each other, right?
Absolutely.
Can I get a couple? Go ahead. We've got a couple of comments.
What came to my mind real quick was a police officer in the school that was removing a young lady from the classroom. He was just flinging her all over the place. But go ahead. What do you have, Ed?
Well, Neil, I have certainly appreciated your straight up honesty throughout this conversation. And I think that when you mentioned people having guns in order to stop situations like this, you may have been expecting some kickback from the chat room. But there are some people asking questions, like Tim asks, what might the training be for citizens in this kind of scenario where they have guns in order to stop another person? Hearing you say violence begets violence, if police officers have a hard time with this, certainly citizens need to be trained in a big way too. What might that look like? Also, there's a tension that I always feel with spreading love. And Suzanne Bukhari talks about this too, while also having violence in your pocket, having a gun in your pocket at the same time. So those are two comments that were brought up by your comment then.
Sure. Well, first, regarding the training and the difficulty that you said that police officers currently have, I think we have, first of all, regarding police, I don't think we've done a very good job at holding police accountable for when they use violence. And that's our fault as a community. And as police leaders, we haven't done a very good job, not just using their firearms, but using other forms of violence and brutality against citizens. We haven't done a very good job at all at monitoring that and at holding our police officers accountable, giving them we can do better with training for them and so on. And when they see that they can commit certain acts of violence when dealing with citizens, and have no repercussions, then yeah, they'll continue to do what they do. So I think that's the main reason we see the problems we have in policing. As far as the training that you would give citizens, obviously on a physical level, the physical aspects of training so that they can properly handle a firearm, and then judgmentally. I mean, in policing, we use a number of different tools to help with judgment. But I think as a citizen, you're going to understand rather quickly, as we do, if you use that firearm, you better be right. You better be right. And you know what? It better be, because someone is about, you know, to take someone else's life. And there is no other option for you, you know. And so I think that, you know, that training can occur. And again, having, you know, that firearm in your pocket or whatever, comes with that is great responsibility, enormous responsibility, you know. And if you can't handle that responsibility, then it's probably not for you. And again, it's only to be used, you know, to save the life of another or other people, you know. And there may be, you know, and many times there are other options before even using that firearm to save the life of other people, and so on. I, you know, again, there is no single panacea for any of these conversations that we're having right now. There are many different aspects. There are many other things that need to be considered. But I guess what, you know, I'm responding to in a nutshell is a scenario in a world right now in this country where we just have an unlimited number of firearms, you know. And if we ever come up with a process, or a number, it's going to take a number of processes for reducing the number and types of firearms in this country, then, you know, you can start undoing, you know, the other things of having people, you know, who can carry firearms. For instance, and I'll end with this regarding this particular question. It was a law passed a few years back, about maybe close to 10 years ago, where if you are a police officer in any jurisdiction in this country, or a retired police officer in good standing, and you stay current with your firearms training, then you can carry a firearm in any state across the country. It's a very, very good law that they passed, because now you've got trained people, you know, who are capable of carrying a firearm across the country, who could potentially be in a place to prevent a mass shooting or a mass murder of sorts. And again, as long as we're in a place where firearms are so prevalent, and like I said, more firearms in this country than there are people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're pointing to something that really we're obsessed about at Raven, and that is educating people about how violence works, just violence itself. What happens when you introduce violence into any kind of situation, any kind of conflict? What happens? How does Absolutely. A situation escalate to the point where violence seems to be a good choice? Like, what, how does that happen, that good people end up thinking that using violence in this situation is good and not a sign of failure, that we failed as good people to keep this situation from escalating to the point of violence? And I think that that kind of education can go on whether or not you're applying to have a license for a firearm or not. I mean, that's the kind of citizen education. If we want to be citizens in a global community in which we're called upon to interact with other nations in this so-called war on terror, we need to understand what the heck we're doing when right. we say, now, okay, now let's drop a bomb on somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. Education is extremely important, because not just me, but I know many, many people who have been through law enforcement careers, who are retired, who still carry a firearm like me, and have never, ever used it. Never used it while they were working as a police officer and what they're and being retired now for many, many years. Because you have the attitude, because of your education and because of, you know, your experiences, you have the attitude that that firearm is not to take a life. It is to save a life. Not to take a life, it's to save a life. And just because you have it and you may, God forbid, have to use it one day, it still doesn't mean that you have to use it in a sense, in a way to take a life.
Yeah.
It's always saving.
That's wonderful, Neil. And I realizing we're kind of at the end of our hour, and we could go on, maybe like the filibuster in the Senate, we could go on for 16 hours, I'm afraid, talking about this. And I didn't even get to ask you about the Freddie Gray, the latest trial where you were actually a witness for the prosecution. But I kind of wanted to talk some more about that, about police accountability and how you, how you create a sense of community between the police and the community and hold police accountable at the same time, because it's going to be a big issue in Chicago. It's on out in the open here. I know it's big news in Baltimore, of course, where you're from. So maybe
two quick comments on that.
Yeah.
Number one, for the immediate, as your listeners here are thinking about their police departments in their towns and cities, for the immediate, think of these things, these four things. Number one, hiring. Making sure that you have a good hiring process where there's a psychological evaluation and other things so that you're hiring the best people. And education. Number two, your training for your new hires. It's got to be training that truly teaches and engages the community. It brings the police, the new police officers, into the community. You should have training components that are actually in the community working and training with the people of the community that they're going to serve. Okay, that familiarizes them with the community. Number three, you've got to have good first-line supervision, responsible first-line supervision. These are the sergeants, the squad leaders, and you've got to hold them accountable. They got to understand that I am accountable for my squad and what they do and what they don't do and how they treat people, interact with people, and I've got to be a coach, and you've got to have good training for those sergeants. Mm-hmm. And then number four, overall accountability and transparency within that agency. Those are the things. If you can solve those four things, you're going to have a wonderful police department that's truly engaged and working well within the community.
Mm.
And the last thing I want to say is the Peelian principles. These are 9 basic policing principles. Okay, so listeners, Google this. It is Peelian, Peelian principles. They were developed in the UK back in the early 1800s. They are relevant today. Many of our police leaders say that they use those principles. Read those principles. If we establish our policing, our police departments and the work that they do upon those 9 basic policing principles, down the road, we'll solve so much. And the police will be part of the community, not partnered with the community. They will, in fact, be the community.
Yeah, you presented those at the conference, and they're just inspiring. It made me want to be a police officer. And nothing has ever wanted me to carry a gun or have that much responsibility before. But it's a beautiful way of describing the mission of police in the community as more of, almost community organizers and peace builders and, sort of glue that holds the community together rather than, I'm in here to bust your head if you misstep or something, And no one wants to be that person, I don't think, seriously.
No.
So it's good for the police and it's good for the community. So Neil, so I don't know how to end except to say thank you for being here, for presenting your honest and clear opinions about these things and challenging us to think about all sides of these issues. And I know there were lots of questions in the chat room we couldn't get to. Maybe if there's a few you wouldn't mind answering sort of in writing or something, we could follow up with a little blog post or something, and maybe invite you back then when you could talk more freely about the Officer Goodson case and other cases like it that are going to be in the news coming up.
Absolutely. So I can answer those questions offline, and also I can send to you I refined the PowerPoint that you saw.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's much better than what it was in explaining the principles. So I can send that to you as well. And you can feel free to share it with your list.
Thank you. That would be excellent, because that is, it is a beautiful, inspiring thing to be working towards. So thanks to everyone who called in and joined in the chat room, and we'll be in touch with you, Neil. Thank you so much again.
Thank you. Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Neil. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.